When I think about the world or trying to understand differences in the world, I think that project has hardly begun.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Political economy, especially the study of institutions and political power, is a strand of development research that in recent years has taught us a lot about, in the name of the famous book, Why Nations Fail, but also what improves their chances of success. So what have we learned in recent years? Which directions for future research are likely to be the most useful? And which insights are creating positive change today? James Robinson of the University of Chicago is, of course, one of the authors, with Daron Acemoglu, of Why Nations Fail, and has continued to develop and refine the insights from that book, notably with 2019's The Narrow Corridor. He joins me now. James, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
In the last 20 or 30 years, catch us up. How much have we been able to learn or better understand about the role of power and institutions in development?
I think we've learned a lot of things. There's still many things we don't understand. I think, you know, the big success is even getting the conversation going. You know, when I was a PhD student 30 years ago, there was no such thing as political economy. Nobody taught it. It didn't exist as a kind of field, and nobody really thought of politics as a source of variation in economic development. If you ask somebody, what's the difference between poor countries and rich countries, they think of a growth model and say, well, you know, poor countries have less capital, the people are less educated, technology is less productive. And then they talk about convergence. And so for me, there was just no proper language for talking about the kind of important differences between poor and rich countries. It just wasn't there. There were people talking about it, like Douglas North, and people in political science like Robert Bates, and even sociology. You know, think about the great work that Clifford Geertz did. But none of that was in economics or being researched by economists. So it was sort of ground zero 30 years ago. And, you know, and it's still a struggle to get people to think about things like that, because in many ways, you know, especially thinking about politics, is so challenging to the economist's paradigm that it's very hard for them to incorporate it. But you can't really escape that anymore. Yeah. I think we've learned lots of things. We've sort of learned big things about correlations between different measures of institutions and different measures of political institutions and economic prosperity, economic institutions and prosperity. You know, we've learned lots of micro things, much smaller things about how power influences resource allocation or how power influences politics kind of in a much smaller context. And we've learned lots of things about mechanisms, but I think we're very far from putting it all together. Perhaps the most obvious example of that is the economic success of China over the past 30 or 40 years, which is very hard to understand from any kind of paradigm, I'd say.
Nevertheless, over those last 30 years, from that beginning, you've been very productive. Daron has been very productive. Many of your colleagues have as well. Are there particular insights that you consider to be robust, important, that stick out in your mind when you think about the work you've done?
You know, I think there's a sort of very broad generalization that spreading political power more broadly leads to better outcomes. Giving power to people who have more of an interest in the provision of public goods leads to more public good provision. You know, I think there's a lot of evidence from mechanisms that suggest that having a broader distribution of political power makes things work better. You know, one of my favorite examples is the work by Jones and Olkin on leadership and economic growth, where they show that if you get exogenous transitions in countries' leaderships, you get big changes in economic growth. But it all depends on institutional quality. So if you kind of divide the world into the half with relatively worse institutions and the half with relatively good institutions, it turns out that this effect only operates in the parts of the world with bad institutions. So that's a beautiful paper about institutions and the mechanisms via which institutions affect prosperity. So I think that that idea of spreading power is good for public good provision. It's good normatively. Of course, that's something we might care about just intrinsically, but it also is good for public policy. I think there's all sorts of evidence for that. But there's lots of other things going on too. So that's a partial statement, which I believe there's lots of theory and there's lots of empirical evidence suggesting, which is nice, but it's hard to add that up into an explanation for why is income per capita 100 times larger in the United States than it is in Sierra Leone.
Your phrase, but there's lots of other things going on as well. It could be a sort of motif for the work that you're doing here. When you read your papers, the books, the questions that you investigate are very difficult questions. They involve philosophical ideas and the contexts are always different. There are long time scales. The data's quite hard to measure. And so the conclusions always have this element of nuance. It's really tough work. Is it important that economists keep asking these questions, even if it is sometimes discouraging because there's no neat answers?
Actually, I don't think there's a neat answer to anything. You know, you can pretend. Yes. That it's just a matter of like how much you pretend. You know, you can pretend there's a neat answer. You can create some little sealed world, you know, where you do some intervention and you estimate the effect or whatever. But there's all this context that world is sitting in that influences massively how people behave and what they think about the intervention and what their preferences are and how they relate to other people. And unless you're conceptualizing that, then to use the technical language, what you have doesn't have much external validity, you know. So it is very complicated. It's just you're pretending it isn't. Robert Solow, the great Nobel laureate, once said, there's two sorts of economics. You can say more and more about less and less, or you could say less and less about more and more. I used to think that was a brilliant insight, but I've come to think it's actually not true. You know, that it's all about pretending. Everything is complicated. Social systems are so complicated. Mm-hmm. We have such imperfect conceptualization of people's motivation and people's ideas about the world and the kind of constraints they're operating under and their aspirations. And so I think we're just stuck with it in social science. That's how it is. And there's many paths to the truth. You know, there's many ways of accumulating information about the world and insights. And you have to use lots of different strategies to piece things together. And so it's all complicated. So, you know, I don't think anyone is really doing anything different than I am.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about those strategies that you use, that desire to say more about more. Compared to when you started out, how much better are the tools that you can use now? How much better data do you have in 2023 to try and resolve these questions?
You know, if I thought about the last 30 years since I was a PhD student, like what's striking to me about economics is not actually the methodology at all. It's not actually about tools or data. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, there's better data. You know, there's better historical data. There's been fantastic work by many economic historians reconstructing historical data that we've used in our work, Angus Maddison's work, many other people. That's great. And there's a lot more data around today that we use, the Afrobarometer, the DHS, whatever it is. Okay. But for me, the striking change in economics is actually much more conceptual. Relative to when I was a student, economics is much more free now. It's not just you can talk about politics, you can talk about psychology. Behavioral economics didn't exist 30 years ago either. You know, you can talk about cultural differences. When I was a PhD student, if you wrote down a model where the equilibrium was inefficient, you were laughed out of the room and said, no, the Coase theorem applies, you know. And I just thought, my gosh, you know, have these people never been in a developing country? The idea that the equilibrium was efficient in Haiti or Nigeria, for me, that was just bizarre experience as a PhD student. You're struggling with these conventional wisdoms and these sort of desiderata saying like, gosh, that doesn't really coincide with what I thought I knew about the world. So I think economics is much more free intellectually now. You can ask any question, you can talk about anything, you know, there's people writing about everything. That to me is way more exciting and interesting and promising than any methodological tool. We use instrumental variable regression a lot. You know, instrumental variable regression has been around for donkey's years. All of these tools have been around forever. Go back to the 1960s, you'd be amazed at how sophisticated people's understanding of many of these problems was. For me, I wouldn't emphasize so much those methodological differences. I'd emphasize much more the conceptual mind opening that's happened in economics, which I find like really exciting. For like a young person, And they don't have to struggle the way I had to struggle. That sounds pathetic. I had to struggle. I didn't really have to struggle. You see what I mean?
There were many, many topics, as you say, could not be discussed in polite economics. It was very difficult to be taken seriously, especially at the beginning of your career. So for those economists who are at the beginning of their career, tell me, what ideas are you finding exciting?
I think there's so many things. You know, when I think about the world or trying to understand differences in the world, I think that project has hardly begun. What's the difference between China or African countries or Nepal or Colombia? One of the problems with a lot of social theory is that it was developed starting in the late 19th century as a sort of generalization of the experience of Western European societies. You know, think about Marxism. You know, Marxism was extremely calibrated to understanding Western industrialization, the bourgeoisie, the proletariat. Where's the bourgeoisie and proletariat in Sierra Leone? It's like it was a generalization of a particular historical experience, which was sort of projected into the rest of the world as if it was all a failed example of England. Development economics, in some sense, is all like that. We're successful and you aren't. So you just need to be more like us in order to be successful. The idea that somehow the Nigerians were different, you know, or the Chinese were different, or they had different ontologies and different ways of thinking about authority and power and the community and property rights. And if you get into an African village, you'll see that this is not like some failed version of Britain. It's something completely different. I think we still haven't really accepted that in economics, and we haven't really taken on board what that means and figured out how to study it. You know, so I tell my PhD students here, oh my gosh, you know, this is just like the most exciting period in development economics. We're only just figuring out that we haven't even started doing development economics yet. We should stop talking about development. Comparative economics. You know, when I was a student at the LSE, comparative economics was like capitalism versus communism. Like, how parochial was that? It all needs to be reinvented. I think also just this whole dissolving of all these artificial barriers between different academic disciplines. There's so much wisdom in political science and anthropology and history and sociology about the world. So don't stay in your silo. There's just so many ideas and insights out there. You've got to figure out how to process them and think about them and incorporate them and bring them into your work. Of course, professional incentives keep you in the silo. So you have to choose your pond. I mean, that's the reality of professional life in academia, I'm afraid. But that doesn't mean you can't bring all these things into your pond. And as I said, for me, that's why I find it so exciting how much more open economics is. Like, that's much more feasible now than it was 30 years ago.
As you mentioned, we have a lot more data now than we used to do. And development economics, or comparative economics, has become very, very data-driven. Is there still room for qualitative research to inform us?
Yes, I mean, of course there is. You know, I think it's, how do you interpret data? Like, you can run a regression. How do I interpret it? People have all sorts of pre-existing ideas and conceptions. One of my favorite examples is this work on civil war. Somebody runs a regression on civil war and GDP per capita and says, oh, countries with higher GDP per capita have less incidence of civil war. Civil wars are less likely to break out. They last less long, etc. Why would that be? Oh, well, it must be because when income per capita is high, wages are higher, so the opportunity cost of fighting is higher, so people don't join rebel groups. Great. Every economist is happy with that explanation. Do we know anything about why people actually join rebel groups from that exercise? We just bring our preconceptions and we apply it to the data. Does that give you the right story? Probably totally wrong. Maybe there's some element of that. So, of course, you need qualitative work. There's just like so many things that we don't understand. Like, I personally don't understand. I mean, when I started doing field work in Africa 25 years ago, because Danny Roderick asked me over lunch, so why has Botswana been so successful? The most successful economy in the world at the time after independence. I had absolutely no idea, of course. So I went to the library, and you can read all the books about Botswana by economists in about 2 days. So I read all the books and I realized there's no explanation here about why Botswana is successful. So then what do you do? Well, you could just give up. But I thought, that's a really good question. I should know the answer to that. So what do you do then?
You
have to go to Botswana, start talking to people, try to understand, what do they know? What do they think? How do they reason about this? And that's actually how I discovered, you know, anthropology of Africa, actually, because if you want to understand anything about what went on in Botswana, you have to understand the anthropology, you have to understand the organization of the traditional societies, you have to understand the history, colonialism, pre-colonialism also. So that was a very powerful experience for me, because I just had to take on board all of these things, which I kind of was thinking about. I just needed that to build an answer which I found credible or interesting. Since that, I've just done endless amounts of qualitative work, because it's just a matter of ignorance, really. Mm-hmm. I just don't feel I understand. Go to Haiti and tell me you understand, like, the equilibrium in Haiti. I mean, we don't understand it.
What you're saying also shows just how important it is to be cautious about making those causal claims that, of course, are the goal of so much of the research that economists do, especially in this area of research.
Well, I think that's fine. You know, if you want to do policy evaluation and you want to evaluate the impact of a policy, modulo these issues I just talked about earlier of not conceptualizing the context or not really thinking through the context, then that's useful. You know, I think that's a useful tool. I think there are important studies like that that have told us about things that I believe. I believe Michael Kremer and Ted Miguel's findings about deworming. I think that's an important thing which improves people's lives. And does that explain why Kenya is a poor country? No, of course it doesn't. And in fact, it's not really about that. You know, it's about policy evaluation. But like, I'm not so interested in that. I think that's an important thing. But I'm much more interested in Kenya and how Kenyan society functions and its history and its institutions and why it's been so difficult for people since independence to create a society that functions and can provide public goods and welfare. And, you know, so I think that sort of methodology is fine, but it's only useful for a very specific sort of question. For me, the big research frontier, and I think there are young people working on this, is how do you take those tools and adapt them to ask bigger, for me, more interesting social scientific questions? You know, there's a very distinguished professor at the London School of Economics, who I won't name, who said to me once, you know, you can't answer any question I'm interested in with a randomized controlled trial. I don't think that's true, actually. I told him that can't be true. It's a tool. You know, it's about the creativity of the researcher. Tools can do anything. You just got to figure out how to do it or how to set the thing up. And so far, most of that literature hasn't thought like that. But I see young people who are thinking like that. And so that is pretty exciting, too. Of course, there's limitations to that, but there's always limitations to everything. That's just how it is.
But give me an example, James, of the sorts of big questions that you feel are really under-researched. I've got a feeling that in your mind, there's quite a lot of them.
I mean, there's hundreds of things we could talk about. But one thing that I guess I've thought a lot about the last few years is we have a very imperfect conceptualization of different sort of political theories, if you like. And if you look at Western thought, for example, go all the way back to Aristotle's Politics, there are these themes, this idea that if you're in power, power will be abused. You need to kind of set up institutions, like Aristotle had his mixed constitution. You need to mix people together. You need to let ambition counter ambition, as James Madison put it in the Federal Papers. And that theme goes right the way through Machiavelli. It's all in there. Thomas Aquinas, Calvin, you know, Montesquieu, you name it, okay? But if you look elsewhere in the world, people's conceptions are completely different. You know, if you look at the Confucian tradition, it's totally different. There's no notion in Confucius that, like, powerful people are going to turn into despots and you have to constrain them through institutions. No, they have to inculcate virtue. So the reaction of someone in Western society to that is, oh, that's nonsense, rubbish. But is it? If you look at Islamic political thought, for example, same thing. There's no concept in Islamic political thought of institutionalized constraints on power. And why? Well, because for a start, an Islamic state was run by, it was like a theocracy. So you wouldn't expect someone learned in the scriptures. You're not worried about him exploiting you. He's an imam. I think if you look in Africa, that's something I've been studying a lot, trying to understand a lot.
There's a huge literature out there, of course, in philosophy about differences in ontologies and different metaphysical beliefs about the world, different political ideas. And again, we all think of them as being false consciousness. For many years, I've taught in Bogota at the University of the Andes, and I always start my first lecture on political economy to these Colombian students with like, okay, so here's the way you should think about Colombia. You're just a failed version of the United States, basically. And I write up, just to provoke them, I write up all the things a good country is supposed to have and how Colombian fails on these dimensions. And I try to sort of get that to foment a discussion of like, is that right? How should you think about these questions, about other different ways of organizing a society? And I think we're so hung up in economics on this so-called, what my colleague Kenneth Pomerantz called, the great divergence. That's the only fact we care about. We're on top and you're not. But this is a moment in world history, it seems to me. There's a great book by Ian Morris, who's a British historian and an archaeologist at Stanford, about this, called Why the West Rules for Now. We can disagree or we could argue about the thesis of Ian's book, but I think the main point of that book is to say, why build social theory based on a couple of years of world history when we know actually thousands of years of world history and when things looked very different and the relative positions of different societies were very different? So why calibrate social theory to this particular epoch in world history? And I guess I find that argument rather plausible. And it's also a very empowering argument for other people in the rest of the world, you know, about you have your ways of thinking and doing things. There's always problems. There's poor people, there's marginalized people, there's repressed people, there's inequality. Yeah, sure. But different societies can have different ways of thinking about that and different ways of operating and thinking of. You get my point. Okay, so we haven't begun to think about that stuff in economics. And I'm going to be too old to make much progress on that. But I think for young people, it's terribly exciting.
One thing that comes through very clearly from your work is just how difficult institutional change is. Do you look around and see the insights from your work being applied and influencing policy?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I'm not really in the business of advising governments. And I find it a bit sort of hubristic to hold forth on the major impact my ideas have had. This year, before things fell apart, I actually was in Sudan. I have a very good friend, right, Ibrahim al-Badawi, who was the Minister of Finance in the transitional democratic government in Sudan. So he's sort of in exile in Cairo now. But in January, there was a negotiation going on and before the war started. And so he invited me to Khartoum and to meet with people, to talk to people in the university and civil society, to give like public lectures. And it was just really fascinating for me in the sense of trying to think about these transitions. Because here's a transition, this long-lived autocratic regime, civil society rises up in an incredible way and contests the power. The regime falls, but then the military comes in. And now it's deteriorated into this horrific civil war. The scale perhaps has never had in Sudan. You know, there's never been a civil war which has incorporated Khartoum, for example. I mean, maybe at the end of the day, that's a good thing because the elites realize, you know, what a disaster this is for them. Mm-hmm. But look at the Arab Spring, the failure of the Arab Spring also. You know, I think that one of the things that Professor Acemoglu and I talk a lot about is why nations fail. We kind of have this idea of elites never give up institutions that favor them unless the powerless contest that. And I think that's right, basically, as a generalization. But most times when the powerless challenge regimes, it doesn't lead to a more inclusive set of institutions. It doesn't lead to a progressive transition. It leads to another kind of autocracy, or at least to violence or civil war. And I think we understand that very imperfectly. So that's something that we've been thinking a lot about the last few years. But just being in Sudan and talking to all these people and just thinking about all the challenges and all the issues that came up in this transition that were kind of very hard to manage, but which allowed the military to come back in and take advantage of what was going on. Yeah, I find it difficult to talk about this issue of policy. I also find it very fraught ethically. I mean, given what's happened in Sudan in the last 6 months, would it have been ethical to go and say, you should rise up, civil society should rise up and challenge the dictatorship? And thousands and thousands of people are being killed and displaced and tortured. And I mean, I don't know. Maybe I should be involved in that. But I find it very difficult philosophically also that, you know, so many unintended consequences of these things. And we don't have this. If you do X, Y, and Z, then everything will be fine. We don't have that kind of understanding of the world. I'm very interested in politics as a scholar. I admire other people's commitment. I have many friends who are politicians, and I find it fascinating. A very good friend of mine, Sergio Jaramillo, who was the Colombian Vice Commissioner for Peace, mm-hmm. who basically negotiated this agreement with these Marxist guerrillas in Colombia for 5 years. We just had so many fascinating conversations about how do you change a society? You know, how can you change Colombia? How can you delegitimize violence as a political strategy? For him, that was the main goal of this. Like, the main goal of this is not get these Marxists to put their guns down. They could pick up new guns tomorrow. The main objective of this is to get to a place where violence is not a legitimate political strategy in Colombia. And he'd always say to me, like, I'd always give him things to read, and he'd always say, oh man, another univariate theory of world history. The only thing you economists care about is one, you have like one variable explains anything. You know, one variable, institutions, cousin marriage, close to the equator. But you know, the world isn't like that, he used to tell me. Like, the world isn't like that.
When things fall apart in places like Sudan, places that you know much better than most of us, does that make you depressed about the prospects for development?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we try to talk about this a bit at the end of The Narrow Corridor. You were kind enough to mention our books. I think the world has got better, you know, in the sense of, think of that, you know, one of the examples we give is like notion of rights. I think this emergence of this notion of rights has been very powerful in terms of the way it affects people's ability to engage in collective action and find common ground. Think about labor repression. One of the biggest features of the pre-modern world was the extent of labor repression, slavery, serfdom, everywhere. We forget about that nowadays, but that was endemic in the world until very recently, 100 years ago or closer to home in many parts of the world. So I think there are forces like that. I think there are slow-moving tectonic forces that make the modern world different from the pre-modern world. I see a spread of democratic institutions. The world is much more democratic than it has ever been historically. Historically, despite all these setbacks we've been talking about and despite all the challenges and despite the fact that, to go back to something we were talking about earlier, you know, in my view, this kind of liberal democracy that we all have in mind as like the ideal political system sort of has the flavor of we have the best system and you should adopt it too. Let me give you just a very simple African example. If you ever get involved in decision making in Africa, the way people make decisions is not there's 51 of us and there's 49 of you, so like we get to, no, you make decisions by consensus. Everyone gets to say, everyone gets to talk. Last summer I went to the Aladinna, which is the sort of village assembly of one of my friend's villages in eastern Nigeria. Mm-hmm. You go to the Aladimna and they're it's in Igbo, you know, so I don't speak Igbo. So the guy, my friend, is translating, whatever. Okay, you deliberate. What happened? What happened? What happened? Chima, what happened? No, nothing. We come back tomorrow. We couldn't agree, you know. So then they go home. They come back tomorrow. You just keep deliberating. You know, now you could say, well, you know, you can run a village like that, but you can't run Nigeria like that. Maybe. But I think one of the problems, of course, is that what's the mapping from those local legitimate institutions to some national institution? I can say, well, Nigeria should be a liberal democracy and there should be this and that and a parliament and blah, blah. But something needs to be more calibrated to the Africans' institutions and the African history and the African's way of thinking about legitimate ways of making decisions. Let me say something very optimistic about the world, which is I actually went to Somaliland, the former British Somalia, which is this sort of de facto independent country for 30 years. And that's an absolutely fascinating example of an African country that got a bit of space through the collapse of the dictatorship in Mogadishu to rebuild itself from scratch, to get together and redesign institutions in a way which fitted with their society. And their society is based on clans. What does the Senate in Somaliland represent? Clans. In the United States, we have a Senate. It's based on states, geographically based. But that makes no sense whatsoever in Somaliland. People migrate with their flocks and stuff. You know, what's the point of representing a piece of desert where there isn't anybody except some sheep, maybe, or camels? So how do you design representation in a completely different society? that was just like eye-opening for me. It was just absolutely fascinating. For me, it's a kind of counterfactual of like what could have happened if Africans had been able to design institutions on their own. And it's not that it isn't democratic. It is democratic, actually. And Africa has a very, very deep history of democracy. Democracy wasn't invented by Greeks or English people or anybody else. Democracy, like agriculture, was invented many, many times throughout history, different parts of the world. You know, there's nothing more democratic than an Igbo village, I can tell you. Everybody has a say. But how do you institutionalize that? That's the trick. Yes, the world is more democratic than it has been before, but there's still a lot of work to do in allowing people the freedom to construct institutions in their own image.
So much to talk about, but James, we have to stop. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
If you want to keep thinking about this, and I can't understand why you wouldn't, then, of course, the two books, James Robinson and Darren Osamoglu, the authors, 2012, Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity and Poverty, and in 2019, The Narrow Corridor, States, Societies and the Fate of Liberty. And also, if you are a Colombian student and you have sat in James's first lecture, please get in touch. I'd be delighted to hear what you thought of it. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where we also have articles about the papers we feature.